Saturday Night Live, Friday Night Speaker Meeting, held at El Paso Shopping Center, room 120, in San Jose, California, on March 13, 1992. Tonight's 10-minute speaker is Mike Dean, and the main speaker is John C. from Los Gatos. The original recording is copyrighted at the Saturday Night Live Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any AA member at the public level. Thank you.
I'm Mike, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mike.
For those of you who don't know me, I don't usually walk that way. But I could. I used to walk worse and sometimes I crawled. That one night I left a cantina down in Cabo San Lucas, and my drinking buddy wanted to help me down the steps, and I told him to go do whatever we tell people to do when we don't want to do what they want us to do. And so he took off with the hotel, and he thought a bunch of Mexicans jumped me and were going to roll me, and they were trying to pull me out of a cactus patch. And I had cactus sticking all out of my ears, and so he nicknamed me the Cactus Patch Kid. And I wound up, I don't know how much hell I raised as he was pulling them some bitches out of my ear, but I was kind of blacked out at the time. And the next morning I remember trying to drink a beer and it wouldn't stay down, you know how that is. And so I decided to go get some lemon lime or something, and I went down to the pool at the El Presidente Hotel in Cabo, a nice place, you know, posh, high rollers, you know. And every time I walked by with people, they would go psst. So I went back upstairs and I said, "What the hell happened last night?" And he says, "Jesus Christ, man." I guess I kind of made an ass out of myself. And so it was kind of a quiet trip home, you know. Well, that happened when I was probably 48 years old. And I started drinking on a regular basis when I was 17. I rolled a car when I was 18, a Volkswagen that I didn't even make a goddamn payment on, totaled it out, broke my foot. I did not get a drunk driving ticket because I worked at a Catholic hospital and I was in love with Sister Mary Teresa. It was the most beautiful looking nun you'd ever seen in your life. And I used to sing Maria to her from the West Side Story and she loved it. She was also the lab technician, and she took the blood results, and when they took my blood, she threw those results away and took my blood 2 days later when I got out of the hospital and told the highway patrol that I wasn't drinking, so I didn't get a drunk driving ticket. But they fired me, of course, because I was drinking. I used to drink these nuns. I liked the nuns because they used to have a lot of wine and a lot of beer because they had doctor's meetings, and the nuns liked to drink. I wonder, there should be more, you know, Dominican nuns in these meetings. I think they come in for the So anyway, that's where I started. I used to steal Ham's beer by the caseload, you know. Jesus. I never made amends for that either. I don't know. Anyhow, I kept drinking, and I decided to sail the world, so I became a merchant seaman because I couldn't stay in college, because I didn't study, because I drank and partied and played in a rock and roll band instead of going to school. And when you don't go to school, you get Fs or incompletes if you're smart. You know, you get an incomplete so it doesn't show up on your record. So I joined the Coast Guard to avoid the draft. And when I got out of the Coast Guard Reserve, after 6 months, I got a merchant seaman's ticket, and I took off for Vietnam as a civilian. And I learned how to drink Scotch whiskey with the old black guys on the ship. And I'll never forget, the guy's name was Paul Kennedy, and he was the first real father figure I had. I knew that guy cared about me, and I knew that he would keep an eye on me, and he did, you know. And he also taught me how to drink like a fish. You know, most seamen drink a lot. And I like to see and I like to drink, you know. And I came back and I decided I was going to be a purser on a ship, which is like the accountant, because that way you didn't have to work too hard and you could just punch in numbers. And then when you went to port, you just gave the people their money and you went out and screwed off all day. And plus, you were an officer, you know. And if I didn't have an education, then I couldn't be an officer unless I had a cushy job like that. So, but I didn't know how to run an adding machine, and I didn't know how to type. And you had to type 50 words a minute and use a 10-key writing machine, so I thought I would go to school to learn that. And I was taking accounting courses by mail, and I was getting good grades in that, so that took care of the accounting part. I went to school, and the first day I was back at school, I saw this little dark-headed Mexican gal walking away from me, and I fell in love. needless to say, I never went back to school. You know, to give you an idea of how I think, I knew exactly who this gal was, where she came from, everything about her. I never talked to her before in my life. She fell in love with one of my roommates, and they were together for a couple of months, and then one night in a drunken party that we had all the time, she and him split up, and then I started befriending her because she was hurting, you know, and and we started seeing each other once in a while, and pretty soon my roommate moved out, and she moved in, and then we got married, you know. That's how you do it. And all the time I drank, and then I decided I had to get a job because I was married, and I went to work for Bank of America, and we moved to Soledad, California, where I was assistant manager of the bank, and I went to a party one night. I was 21 years old, a business meeting, and then a party afterwards, and I got drunk again, and we had a brand new Datsun station wagon, a 510 sedan station wagon, four-door deal, and I rolled it down the middle of Highway 101, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, and this kid came along and he said, "Tell the cops you're in shock and everything will be okay." So I did that, you know. They said, "Well, do you have somebody to call?" And I gave them our phone number. Of course, I didn't know my phone number because I was drunk. And they said nobody was home, and that pissed me off because I knew my wife was there all by herself, and I had to tell her that I wrecked a car and I'd be home shortly as soon as they let me go. And so they threw me in the highway patrol car. So I got on the highway patrol guy's radio to straighten this out, you know. That's not a good thing to do. So I got arrested for drunk driving, I tell you. 21 years old, nice suit, you know, a whole enchilada. And the kid went up, he knew where we lived, and he went up and got my wife. And I think about that today. She was 19 years old at the time. And what it must have been like to her at 3 o'clock in the morning to have some stranger beat on the door and say, "Your husband's in jail and you need to get some bail and go get him out," you know. And she did that for me, you know. 19 years later, we went to dinner at Big Will's. I was throwing a party for a bunch of people that I worked with and business associates. And that same woman that had put up with all of my drinking and all my bullshit up to that point in life was not giving me what I wanted. We'll just leave it at that. And I told her that was no problem because I could get what I wanted wherever I wanted, whenever I want. You know, what we say when we're in one of those deals. And she immediately ejected me from my house, and I was never allowed back in, you know. In the meantime, getting what I wanted when I wanted in Oregon, I'd gotten another drunk driving ticket on my 38th, right after my 38th birthday, or 39th birthday. Then one of the things you have to do when you get a ticket nowadays is come to these goddamn AA meetings, you know, and go to drunk driving school so you can learn how to drive when you're drunk. That's what I thought they did. So some of these stupid meetings, and I was out of the house, and I met this young lady at a drunk driving school, and so we decided to go to meetings together. And then we'd go drink afterwards. And she started drinking and doing drugs more than going to the drunk driving classes, so she got kicked out, and I still had to go to a meeting. So I asked somebody, and it was my fatal mistake, or maybe the greatest blessing that ever happened to me, where another meeting was, because I wasn't too impressed with the, you know, we were going to the east side with like 6 people, and most of them were winos that had to go there, you know, and AA did not really appeal to me. And I came to a Saturday Night Live noon meeting, and halfway through that meeting, I said, "This is home, man. This is where I need to be." You know, people were having fun, and I felt comfortable in a room full of people that weren't drunk. Well, some of them were probably drunk, but they don't, you know, we don't stand up and say, "Oh, I'm drunk today," you know. But I enjoyed the meeting, and I forgot my slip, and I didn't get my slip sign, so I had to come back again. And then for some stupid reason, I thought, well, I'll just keep coming back. Now, I didn't realize you were supposed to stop doing drugs because it was an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I got a very analytical mind. So I was going to stop drinking. Now, if I felt comfortable with that, I'd stop smoking dope. And then if I got comfortable with that, I'd stop doing coke, you know, because those were my 3 normal daily substances, you know. And especially when I decided to stop drinking, they became more and more important to me, you know. But they made the stories at the AA meetings a lot more enjoyable than they probably were, you know. And the women always looked a little better, too, you know. So anyway, I stayed here. And I listened enough to hear a message that I didn't have to drink anymore if I didn't want to. I found out I had a disease called alcoholism. And that disease was activated every time I took a drink. And that it created a mental obsession that caused me to want to keep drinking. And I didn't know that. I thought I was just a drunk. I knew I was a drunk, you know. But I didn't know how you quit drinking, and I didn't know why I kept drinking, you know. But it always puzzled me why I couldn't just take a drink and stop. You know, sometimes I could, but sometimes I couldn't. And then sometimes you just keep drinking, you know, what the hell you did. You know, you wake up the next morning in Mexico with people like that, you know. And that was just one of the times. I was a blackout drinker, you know. So I met a guy in AA about a month or two after I was here. I started in October, and sometime in late November or early December, I met a guy, and he's going to speak later tonight. And he taught me how AA works, you know. And it's a real blessing. I kind of finagled a 10-minute deal here tonight because he's important to me. He just had 16 years of sobriety, you know. I've been through a lot of bullshit in sobriety, and I just want to say I love you. That's hard for me to do, as he knows. But it's been over 5 years for me, you know. And it's an honor to be here. And it's an honor to be sober, you know. I didn't know what it was like. I didn't have any idea. And I hope you listen to this guy because he's changed my life. Not just him, the program, but he's been an example of what this thing is. You know, and I look around the room before I spoke tonight, and I see all the people whose lives have been affected from what he did for me and what I've been able to pass on to other people and what they've passed on to other people. It's just amazing, you know. Just fucking amazing. I know we're not supposed to say that word, but there's some people that, you know, it just slips out. And besides, I'm not well yet, you know. I don't want to be well. I just want to be comfortable, you know. And I am comfortable today. Thank you.
My name is Donna, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm looking around to find out if anybody got anything to throw. I want to congratulate our 10-minute speaker. I think that was an outstanding pitch. He certainly got a lot better in his last 5 years. I was telling a few people that 5 years ago, give or take a month or so, I had an opportunity of speaking up the peninsula, and I was asked to bring a 10-minute speaker. And Mike had, I think, 30 or 60 days at that time, and I asked him if he wanted to come along and be my 10-minute speaker, and he said yes. And I went up there, and he stood up in front of the group, and he gave his 10-minute pitch. And when he was all over, he came down and sat down beside me. He said, how did I do? I said, you took 8 of my minutes. He's got a lot better. I introduced myself as an alcoholic. And that's a piece of information I didn't have before I got here. I did not know anything about the disease of alcoholism nor what alcohol had done to me and for me. I only knew that my life didn't work and hadn't worked for a hell of a long time. And I had another one of those many, many spiritual awakenings that do occur that I think is absolutely outstanding. Because I am sober today by the grace of a loving God as He manifests Himself through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's important for me to know. You see, my sobriety date is March the 12th, 1976. I'm well into my 17th year of sobriety. But the story I want to tell you occurred on March the 11th, 1976, and it was in a bowling alley, in the saloon portion of that bowling alley. And I was ingesting some things called Jack Daniels over with a splash of soda. A very refined drink for a refined drinker. And this young man, there was a young man who had gone to an AA meeting. This happened to be on a Thursday night, and he went to the gorilla meeting. And after the gorilla meeting, he came to the bowling alley. And he looked me up in the saloon, and he started talking to me. And for reasons that I had no understanding of at all, I agreed to come to an AA meeting. And somewhere between 10:30 and 11:30 that night, I put down a drink. And I have not found it necessary nor any need of taking it up again. And a miracle happened, and it was just the other night, last Wednesday night. I haven't seen this young man in a long time. Last Wednesday night, on March the 11th, around 9 o'clock, my bell rang, and I answered, he was standing at the door. He wanted to relive what occurred 16 years before. And it gives me warm tingles because of the love of Alcoholics Anonymous that entered into my life. And as a result of coming here, everything that is of any value to me has been given to me because of you. And because of that innocent exchange from a young man who had 5 days of sobriety, a debt beyond my ability to repay was given to me by someone not knowing any of the rules and regulations of how to 12-step somebody, came out and grabbed some poor slob and brought him to the message. And I want you to know that I eagerly received that message, as most of us have. I was a captive in his car when I went to my first meeting, and the first sucker I met insulted me. Son of a... He introduced himself and said, "I understand you have a problem with alcohol." And I said, "Doesn't everybody?" And the bastard said, "No." That was enough to really get me off. I listened to the insanity that went on in that meeting. You people were crazy. You laughed at inappropriate times. You talked about sensitive issues that should never be discussed with anybody. And then you laughed just like that. Yeah. I heard one thing of any of real value that evening, and it started me thinking, because I was mad. I was seething. I know when they called on me in that meeting, because they had the presence of mind to recognize a man of stature. I was not anonymous then. I told them, "I'm here to find out what the creeps do on Tuesday night." That was my best contribution with all the love I was capable of offering. But I heard somebody say in that meeting that you never have to drink again as long as you live if you don't want to. And I heard something different that changed my life that night. I didn't hear what maybe most people heard. Then you hear drinking. I heard have to. And it started my mind thinking, because it never entered my mind that I had to drink. And when I met the second resentment I got that evening, which was, of course, the second guy I met, after the meeting, I'd escape. I'd have run if I wasn't locked up in this guy's car. He inferred that I didn't have enough guts to make it for 90 days. Oh, they treated me kindly. And so I, combination of came back at him. And this is the scenario. This is what happened to me. On the first night, I hated you. And you gave me a piece of information I took home that I started thinking about. And I got mad at you enough to come to my second meeting, and that was on a Friday night. My first meeting was on a Tuesday night. My second meeting was on a Friday night. And the people were infinitely less offensive that evening. They seemed to be a little more gentle, and nobody insulted me, and you gave me another piece of information that I was able to take home with you. You said, and I don't know why I heard it, it said that today was gone. Today, tomorrow, you will never have. Yesterday is gone forever, and today's it. This is all you've got. And for some reason, I went home with that thing, and I said, "You mean I can't do anything about my tomorrows or fix yesterdays?" And for some reason, I tried that thing. And for the first time in unbelievable number of years, I went to sleep like a little baby. I didn't have to relive the horrors that I've relived over and over and over again for countless times. And so with that piece of information and still trying to understand why I had to drink, I agreed to go to my partner. My friend called me up and asked me if I wanted to go back to that Tuesday night meeting. And I said, "I'd like to find out if they've gotten any better." And I went back, and they had, although they didn't call on me. They made it a point of not doing that for months. But they got better, and I felt better, and they gave me another piece of information. And they started talking about love, and that set me on a search. They said that we will love you. And it set me on a search, and I started trying to figure out what love meant. I tried to figure out what had to meant. And I went, my friend called me up, wanted to know if I wanted to go to another meeting. I went to a meeting. It was on Friday night. They were a nicer group. They were infinitely nicer than the time before. And something happened on that magic night, because I was happy. The information was working. I hadn't drank for a while, I didn't even know that. I just went to meetings. I fell in love that evening. I fell in love with recovery. I bought a book. I bought the 12x12. I had already had the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by then I'd already read it twice. Critically, you understand, not for content. Just for what was wrong with it. But I fell in love with that night, and I know that that was on a Friday night, and on Saturday I called my friend and I said, "You want to go to a meeting?" He said, "No, I didn't." And so I got in my car and I went to my first AA meeting all by myself. And it started a pattern for me that has resulted in all of the good things that I've ever wanted. You see, I envy, in some respects, I certainly envy a man like Mike who can talk about it, his drunkologue or portions of his drunkologue and have some good laughs with it. You see, it seems as if I cannot remember those times. Now, I'm sure I have them, but I don't seem to remember them. All that I know about my disease of alcoholism is what I can offer a very... initially, I didn't think I had one, so when you ask about a drunk story, I'd lie to you. I'd tell you stuff. And I didn't know what it was. I'd just tell you stuff. It didn't make any difference because I wanted to stay here. But Mike was talking about it. He's saying some funny things that happened to him. I had some stupid and some amazing and some disgusting things that I did. I was a very gentle little boy. Strange. Gentle little boy. And I was a good child. My mother said that I was a good kid. I was athletically inclined and in school, and I did fairly well. Quite well. As a matter of fact, if you went on around, you might find a record book with my name in it. But that's neither here nor there. My ego will not permit me to tell you I'm just average. You see, I've got to be just better or worse. But I was, I'm only talking about the formation of the child. That's all I'm talking about, because you see, I happen to believe that I was born with a physical allergy. And I know for a cold fact that I'm allergic to two substances now. I'm allergic to strawberries and alcohol. You know, it's kind of an interesting thing, is it shows you how hard we learn the lesson. When I was around 4 or 5 years old, I had some strawberries. And I almost died. They came within an inch, not saving my life that night. And I haven't even thought it necessary to sample a strawberry from that moment to this. But when I picked up my first bottle, as a retarded child of 18, and I sucked that in, and I grew to be the big 6-foot-4 man I've always wanted to be. And I was more than willing to take on any fool who wanted to challenge me, because I've never met the man I couldn't beat that night. I continued to do that for 30 years, and never entered my mind it might be harmful for me, until I got here. No, I was a gentle, athletically inclined young man until one day, as in an Irish family, my father happened to be an Irishman. That's why my last name is Carney, probably. He had his forte of, they come from a large family, and one of the things is that you had to prove yourself a man with my father. And when I was 16 or 17, I do not know which, he decided it was time for I had to prove myself to be a man, and I had to fight him. And I have 4 brothers, and none of the 4 brothers ever fought him. And I envied him for that, because I thought it was a very magnanimous thing to do, not have to fight your father. But I fought him, and I beat him savagely. And something happened inside of me. My father carried those scars to his grave. Something happened into me that night, because, you see, I became somebody. Now, I already was somebody. I was doing things, and I was known, but I really became somebody. And when you become somebody, you got a lot of rights to protect. And you got a lot of people who are looking at you funny, and you have to discuss that with them. Because you become awfully damn important. And when I picked up the bottle 2 years later, when I was in the Army, I was off and running, and I had what I like to remember, or think I had just a wonderful time, for 2 years. I was looking for somebody that would want to fight me. And that's not because I was picking fights. That's nothing. That's not saying anything other than the alcohol that was in my system demanded an outlet, and the way I sought it was to try and find somebody. Fortunately, I never found anybody who could kick my ass, although a few wanted to try. I married my high school sweetheart, and when we had our first child, my life changed dramatically. Because prior to that, someone had tried to molest the lady in a street in Los Angeles. That's where I was from. And in the street fight that ensued, that a couple of people had to go to the hospital, and one of them died. And as a result of that, I had to become peaceful. And my wife delivered a little baby, and I suddenly realized that what I was doing no longer was acceptable to me. That I had to become a good father, I had to become a good husband, I had to take care of my kids, and I became a good businessman. And I was good at what I did, apparently, because I was quite successful. And you see, this is where I come from. This is perhaps why I managed to drink for 30 years, is that when I made the decision that I had to take care of my family and do things, I stopped drinking. Not because I was drinking, just because it didn't happen. It got in my way. I started doing other things. And as I became more successful, I started drinking more. And the more successful I got, the more I drank. And 11 years later and 5 children later, I'm a tremendous success in Southern California. I'm drinking like a fish. And I'm on a running drunk because I too am a blackout drinker. And I was on a running drunk. And I wake up talking on the telephone and to hear that my wife had committed suicide. And I went absolutely stark raving mad. And it took an awful lot of people and an awful lot of effort to put me in a straitjacket and haul my little ass away and put me in a psychiatric room in the Los Angeles General Hospital. And between the fog, I remember the agony of, where's my kids? What am I doing here? How am I going to get out? What's happening? The company that I worked for, that I was so successful with, sent word that they didn't like the way I did business, and they were fired me. And I got out after a short period of time, as most alcoholics seems to be able to do, I managed to con my way out of this. I was absolutely stark raving crazy. And I persuaded them to leave me out of there in 4 days without further need of psychiatric care. And I brought my kids to Northern California, and the reason I brought my kids to Northern California, nobody in Southern California would hire me. Because I had a reputation, I was well known in the industry, and nobody would hire me, and I came north. I brought my 5 little girls to Northern California, 2 of them in diapers, and I proceeded to stop drinking because it got in my way. I had to learn how to keep house, change diapers, because 2 of them were in diapers. Iron. That's just better. Now, I'm so old, this is before wash and wear. I want you to understand that. And my girls had these fabulous dresses. And my oldest daughter had this pretty. This is still ladies. Men just sit quiet. But this, there's some ladies in here that know what an iron is. Maybe a couple of guys are. But I've listened to the ladies, my mother, tell me about ironing, and she's saying, God, stand before this iron and on this for hours and hours and hours. And I said, well, hell, I'll learn how to iron sitting down. And if you do that, you have to iron left and right handed, by the way. I'll just tell you that if you haven't learned it. And I would go to work, I'd come home and I'd do all the washing and the cooking and the ironing and put the kids to bed and bathe them and get them up and fix their lunches and take them to school and do all and go to work and all the rest of that crap. But I was sitting there, because my life was starting to go in, I got a routine, and I was starting to sip a little bit of Jack Daniels in the evening because I had to get a little relaxation, for Christ's sake. And I was ironing my daughter's dress, and it was the most gorgeous thing you'd ever seen. It was a brown peasant-type dress with white lace all the way, white yoke, puff sleeves, and ribbons of lace all the way down. They were just the most pretty thing, and she looked like a doll. This is my oldest girl. And while I was drinking, it seemed as if between ironing and drinking that I got a big scorch marks on the white lace. And I spent the rest of the evening, including the bottle of Jack Daniels, scorching all the rest of the lace to match. And she had the prettiest brown dress you've ever seen in your life. But that's why a little kid should be drowned, because she never wore it anymore. I never understood that. What a snot. I became a wheel in the company that I was with, and the company that had fired me had to do a contract with the company that I was with, and I hated them. And they had a contract. They had to come to me to do business with me. They didn't have any choice. And I knew every one of the filthy, rotten bastards. And one day, a young lady from the production control plant of production control department of this company called me, and she talked to me. She was very pleasant. I liked her, and I started to insist that all the other wheels, including the owner of this multi-million-dollar corporation that had 18 branch offices, go talk to that lady and have her call me, because I'm going to talk to you, you bastard. So we got to know each other fairly well, because I spent a lot of time on the telephone. I finally decided to hire her. But before I did that, I took her out. She was unfavorable, very unfavorable. I thought she wore falsies. She didn't take care of her kids. She had a boy and a girl, and the girl had a ragged nightgown, not like my children. Little snot was leaning out a two-story window and could have fallen out. She wasn't taking care of those kids right. I took her out, had a lot of fun. She was a lot better when you got to know her a little bit. I called her up a week later and asked her if she wanted to go out. She knew, and I managed to get a babysitter. I ran over to her house, and very simple, she molested me. 8 weeks later, I married her. So overnight, she had 7 kids, and she was 26. If I've done nothing in this life, I have managed to take a born Al-Anon to fulfillment. That lady had been looking for a drunk all her life. And I told her that evening, I said, honey, hit his right cunt. Stick with me, baby. A lot of claps. Stick with me, baby. And what are the places you've never gone? And what are the things you've never done? And I'll take you to places you've never been. And boy, did I fulfill that statement. 9 years before I got here, we've been married for 7 years, approx. I hit the lowest part of my life in Fresno, because by then my life was on a downhill spiral. And I wasn't able to do without drinking very well, because I was drinking constantly. I was a downhill run, and I was sitting in Fresno. I'd lost everything again. I managed to know for a cold ass fact I've done it. I've blown it all over. My wife doesn't like me anymore. The kids are afraid of me. I can't make a goddamn living. I can't even get a job. I'm totally useless. I'm an absolute failure, plus I'm bankrupt. And then my wife says she's pregnant. Well, that doesn't sound like anything. You know, a couple of twiddles out here. And, you know, oh, isn't that wonderful? But you see, when you have had a vasectomy, and your wife is medically incapable of conceiving, and she says you're pregnant, you think a little bit about it. And you have to go to a saloon or two and discuss it with people. That was 9 years before I got here, and I was condemned to live longer, and that's all I was. The lights had gone out, and it was a gray world, and the light had gone out, and I was condemned to live here. The line in the book I've often times quoted was mine, is I had but one alternative to continue this path, to continue this way of living, eking out just living as best I could. But you gave me another alternative when I got here. You see, I lost the battle of life 9 years before I got here, and when I got here, something happened. Because I think I ran out of time. I really do believe I ran out of time. I can't afford to do what I've done anymore, and you offered me a solution. 4 months into my intense working, studying the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the like, I had a profound spiritual experience, and it was one of the most painful and agonizing experiences of my life. But the veil was lifted from me, the self-deception was taken from me, and I became aware of the depths of my disease, and I knew true fact why it was that I have been to jail. I knew what caused me to go into the nut house. I had looked down the barrel of a .38 with somebody in the hammerback that wanted so desperately for me to move that it was just a senseless series of bad breaks in my life. I have wound up in the wildest, stupidest places that were inconceivable to me, that had no understanding whatsoever. I was sharing with somebody, I was a few years sober, and I suddenly remembered the time I was in Chico. Oh, a wonderful place is Chico. It's just a half a step above Fresno. And I'm in this $5 motel. I always did go first class. And I wake up, and I don't know where I've been, and I'm sitting there bald, naked, and I'm covered with yellow marks all over my body. No, purple marks all over my body. I haven't the faintest idea what they are. And I said, how in God's name am I ever going to explain this to my wife? Jesus, purples, and I'm not an adventurer. I'm not an adventurer. All I need to do is peacefully get drunk and fall over. And I have long since stopped the fights, and I didn't want to do that. I'm not into that crap. Thank God they washed off. What a freaky thing, huh? What they were, and I have no idea what they were, and I just can't, wouldn't that be grand? Here's your honey, here I am. But it's bad breaks. I slept in the wrong places with the wrong people, doing the wrong stuff. I couldn't understand it. My brother-in-law and sister-in-law said they couldn't quite understand me. He said, John, you have more talent than anybody I've ever seen, but boom, got a lot of bad breaks. I've had a lot of bad breaks. God, I persevere. I am working hard. And I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you said that it's not a higher code of standards that you require. If anything, you need to lower your standards to something that you can live by. And you gave me a set of, you started to give me some understanding. One of the first things you that I heard you teach, that I learned from you, you said practice these principles in all of your affairs, and a much more important part of these demonstrations of these principles lies at home in my respective affairs. And so the first thing I did is I took these principles as I understood them home to my wife. And I asked somebody, I think I asked somebody, I said, well, how do I treat her? You know, she's really a bitch. She has turned into some frigid ice queen. She just never talks. She just, the ice palace is hers, and that's called the bedroom. You don't visit there except just to put your clothes on in the morning after she wakes up. And they said, treat her like another alcoholic. I said, great. Every alcoholic knows more than I do. And he said, you're getting it, John. So I went home, and I started treating her like an alcoholic, and I started listening to her. I did dangerous things. I mean, I did. I said, honey, you can tell me anything you want to. Bitch did, you know? Now, I don't call her that. I am doing that for effect. I do not call my wife that. I don't talk that way about ladies. Because part of that is not because I'm good, not because I'm naturally good, not because of anything I have. That's part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I might even share that with you as I trudge this road of happy destiny. I came in here not believing in God, not wanting to, nor willing to accept it. The first thing you told me, you said I should learn how to pray. And I told them I wasn't willing to. And they said, you have to become willing. And I said, oh, I'm not willing to learn how to pray. And I wound up writing in my book, The Secret, and it was I became willing to become willing to become willing to pray, to learn how to pray, and I thought I was safe. And somebody gave me a damn book, and I started reading it, and it was a book on prayers. I didn't realize I got trapped into praying. In a very short period of time, the prayers started to change, because I didn't like the way they wrote them. They had a lot of D's and thous, and they didn't say what I really meant. And I'd drive in a car. Nobody's going to catch me praying. I can talk in a car, but hold on. I'm right in there. I'm reading these prayers. I'm talking, waving at the people going by. Just having a wonderful time. Now, erase that. Change it. This is the way it's going to be. And things started happening. And pretty soon, the prayers become less formal. Pretty soon, I started to understand things about it. Pretty soon, I started to get involved with the recovery of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I understood what this physical allergy was. And I never hit any bottles. No, I didn't hit any bottles. I had a lot of money. I used to buy a case of Jack Daniels and quartz, sitting in the garage. I didn't hit. My hiding of bottles was when it got half empty, I kept sneaking quartz in so it would never get empty. That's the way I hit my damn bottles, you know. The insanity of this. I had to start following that stupid streetcar, that dumb fool who was jaywalking. I never understood that fool. That guy was stupid, you know. Anybody that do that would be absolutely crazy. And the self-deception and behind that stuff. I remember sitting in a saloon and saying, oh, well, I'll have one before I have lunch. And I put a $5 bill out. And I had it. Well, I'd best wait until the $5 is gone. and I'd put out three because two would come out even because I had to have come out even, you understand? You can't walk away with any change. Tip him though, those bastards make enough money. That's the way. I'm not friendly. I never have been friendly. And that's when I started to understand a little bit about the disease of alcoholism. Now I recognized and I started to equate it with the fact that I have a physical allergy, just like my strawberries. And then if I continue to take that, and I know that I'd continue to take it because I started to remember back when I would have be forced to go to some place where they would really only have one drink. Can you imagine that? My wife knew people and asked me to come and visit them who, honest to God, only served one drink. Oh, what agony. You wind up not drinking it because you know damn well that it'll light a fire. It has to be put out. And I started to realize that, and I started to get a better understanding. Because I knew that was the problem. Lack of power was my problem. That was the problem. And the solution had to be from the power, where you had said I had a power greater than myself that would restore me to sanity. The problem and the solution. The problem was lack of power. The solution is power. Power through of the program. Power of a loving God working through the mind. Restoring me to sanity. And I looked these things up and I recognized sanity happens to be soundness, wholeness of mind, rational thinking. If the power is going to work through me, it has to come through the mind. I knew that when I started working those 12 steps. I went into the back of the book because you started talking weird crap. You started talking about religious things, you started talking about spiritual stuff, and I've been spiritual, and I've got in my mother once with, and I was heavily involved in a spiritualist religion, and I'm not knocking at it, and we had things floating around the room, and voices, and lights, and I said, yeah, I've been through that. I don't want to do that. I'm waiting for somebody to start raising chairs in this damn room. God, I'm glad there was nobody around like sounded like me when I got sober. I'll tell you that. I probably would have run. A good friend of mine said, John, first time I heard you, I knew something happened. I said, wow, you know, damn, what did I do? He said, you really changed my life. I said, what did I say? What did I say? He said, it wasn't what you said, John. He said, I knew something had happened to me. I couldn't quite figure out whether I'd just been married or buried. Everything has changed about me, including my voice. I guess it's still changing tonight. But nobody has ever said anything about my voice before I got here, and they seem to say a lot of things about it since I've been here. But I... In the back of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, see, every answer I've ever looked for has been in the book for me. Every answer I've ever looked for has been in the book for me. So I look in the back of the book and it talks about religious experiences, it talks about spiritual awakening, it talks about vital spiritual experiences, vital awakenings, and things of that type, and it also talks about a personality change. So, and they, in the back of the book, under religious experience or under spiritual experiences, they all mean the same thing. And I knew that I could be willing to accept a personality change. And so that barrier was off. It said, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And I had, since I was a man, this crazy fool that I'd picked to be my sponsor, wouldn't sponsor anybody who had less than 4 months of sobriety. I had a lot of loose time. I didn't know he was nuts. He's not my sponsor today. I asked a different man when I got to it, but what I was doing is trying to determine whether I was willing to go to any lengths to get here, to stay here and get what you had. And I started looking at things and become willing to recognize. I didn't know how. You see, I didn't know how to become a gentleman, and I didn't know I could live that way. But I wanted to be one, and I was afraid to. But I had to become willing to be a gentle person. And that was not an easy thing. I've been mad and furious all of my life. I had to become willing to let my anger go. I suffer from another crippling disease. This is a crippler. It's not as deadly as alcoholism, but it's crippler. And the reason I'm 32 years ago, I walked into a place, I crawled in I was wheeled in on a wheelchair and was told I would never walk again. And I got absolutely furious. I got so mad I did a lot of obscene things, and I got up and stormed out and said, I'll You'll never get me in a goddamn chair again. And I lived on anger. And when I became willing to anger, I used to go to my doctor. I'd get so full of pain, and I'd hobble into my doctor. About every 6 months, just a regular zone, I'd walk in, I'd say, "Fix me!" God, I hated him. He hated me. I hated him. I had to make amends to him. I'd go in there and say, "Fix me!" He said, "I can." I'd get so furious at him, I'd walk out, and I'd be good for 6 months. When I made amends to him, I'm sitting there, I got a tremendous bad case of bursitis. Oh, God! And he'd get this needle. Have you ever done that? And he'd stick that needle in your shoulder, and he jams that sucker down right to your toes. And then I said, "Doc, got to tell you something." He said, "What?" I said, "You're really not a prick. I'm making amends." I said, "Really, you're not a bad person, and it's my fault, and I'd like to apologize for all the things that I've done to you." He said, "You stupid bastard, you're the only fool I've ever known that would do something like that when I got a needle up in a foot and arm." Fortunately, I don't go to him anymore. I become willing to start letting go of things. I become willing to surrender this feeling of that I had to control things. I become willing. I didn't know how to do that, but I became willing to do that. And as soon as that happened, I had my fourth month. Is when his spiritual awareness came through, and I saw the deception that had occurred, and I was able to take my first, second, and my third step was a very priceless experience with me. I took my third step with my wife, with one of my daughters, with my son, and with the young man who brought me to my first meeting. We did it up in the mountains, only because I believe in this life, and I believe that sobriety is a celebration. We went up to the mountains and we kneeled. I've had so many spiritual and vital spiritual experiences you just wouldn't believe. And I could talk about them all day, but I had this vital spiritual experience. I went up there and we kneeled and I turned my will of my life over to the care of God. My wife did that to herself and my daughter did that. They were not yet in Al-Anon or Alateen, but they wanted to do it because they've always had a religious or a spiritual program. My little son pulled on his mother's arm and said, "Mommy, will you do it for me?" And Peggy turned his life over to the care of God, as well as his business. And that young man has born with a learning disability and a crippling disability. We found it fairly early, and he was getting special schooling. And 2 weeks after this third step, the school district called my wife and said, "Mrs. Carney, would you come in? We need to talk to you about your son Daniel." And she said, "It appears as if something's happened to that boy because he's not no longer learning disabled. We don't know what it is." So Peggy went to the doctor who he's been under constant treatment and medication with, and the doctor said, after examining, he says, "Well, it's one of those strange things. Seems if it's spontaneous remission, it may come back, but it's gone." I've had so many, many spiritual experiences and vital, and one of the precious things that is still a fundamental part of my life, that was my third step. One of the spiritual things that was so vital to me, and it's not necessarily big deals, because you're talking about a personality change, and I like to share this because it's a real key part of my life, is that I came home one day, and I was talking to Peg, and I said, because I share everything, I made a dreadful mistake with sharing with your wife. I mean, good God, you might become friends, you know? Just dreadful. But you got to be prepared. They'll talk back. I mean, really. God, amazing things that I've taught that woman. It just mind-boggles me. I came home one day and I said, "Peggy, I have a funny feeling." She said, "What's the feeling?" I said, "I don't know. I just have a funny feeling inside of me." And she said, "Well, is it good or bad?" And I said, "Well, it's good because it isn't bad." And I said, "But I have nothing to feel good about." And she said, "Well, if you're going to call it something, what would you call it?" And I said, "Impending good." Impending good. We all know impending doom. I live with it. But there is a thing called impending good that is available to us if we do certain things. And I believe in that because it's never left me. Sometimes it's so outrageous, I know I've just won the lottery. You know, it just that strong and so feeling. And sure, I've had my ups and downs in sobriety, but the feeling is so intense and so grand and so beautiful. I did my fourth step, and huge revelations occurred in my process of my fourth step. I suddenly realized why I did the things that I have done. How many times have I had to wake up the equivalent of seeing all the bodies and the crap and the garbage and the mush lay on the floor and say, How did this happen? Because I have always tried, all my life I've tried, to be a good father, a good husband, a good citizen, and a fair-minded human being, and I failed dismally. And when I wrote my fourth, I found out what motivated me and caused me to do things. And I found out that I, in true fact, was a victim of myself. Instincts run amok. And baby, don't get in my way if an instinct is between me and you, because I'm going to blow you away or get it done. Because I had restored to sanity. I had money. I'll buy it, and I won't do it myself. I went to my sponsor. My sponsor was a cold-hearted slob. I said, I'm ready to do my fifth step. He says, I'm not ready. And I said, I am. And so I sat down and waited. He says, I'm busy. And I said, I'm not. It was a business day. And a few hours later, he said, you finally serious? And I said, yes. And here I had the dreadful sequence of John Carney that the world was going to die with. Nobody's going to see them. And we went to a restaurant, for Christ's sake. And in a booth, right beside the front door of the Sherwood Inn on Almaden Road, I did my fifth step. He came to me and he said, after this done, he said, you've done a good job. I knew I had. He verified it. I was delighted with that piece of information. He said, you go home and take the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous out and read what you do from here, because next is 6 and 7. And I went home and I found out 6 and 7 was, for me, the essence of willingness. I was entirely ready. I had information to take to the God of my understanding. I was now ready to let this stuff go. I had a 7-step which ensured me that I was humble. I had a true understanding of myself, the basic ingredients of a true understanding of self, and a willingness to grow into the kind of person I always wanted to be. I had that knowledge, and I fell on my knees that evening, and I went to the God of my understanding, and my prayer was so very simple. It still is. It's the same one I always use. Father, you tell me, and I'll stop. Because it's the problem of the alcoholic working in my mind. I hear people talking about conscience and going right from wrong and all the rest of that stuff. I never deliberately hurt anybody in my life. I hurt plenty. Never once. Good God, I've participated basically in one form or another actively in the death of several people. Never once was it consciously an effort on my part to hurt them. The pain of that is awesome when you've got to live with it night after night after night, drowning yourself with alcohol. And I didn't know what was causing it. And I was unwilling to allow that to continue. And that's why my 6 and 7 step was, Father, and is today. You tell me and I stop. Now I have a quiet voice. Now my job is to learn how to listen. Stopping is a piece of cake. Knowing what you're stopping from is easy. I don't know how to get to heaven. There's a quote that's so beautiful. If I ever find my way into heaven, it will be because I'm backing away from hell. If I ever do the right thing, it'll be because I'm not doing the wrong thing. What a beautiful thing it is. I know a list of things not to do. I got so many not to do's you wouldn't believe it. But you see, if you keep not doing what you're not supposed to do, you start doing things you're supposed to do. And when you find out you're not supposed to do it, you don't do it anymore. It's beautiful. I made a list of people I had harmed. And I had it basically in my 4-step. And I made amends to him, and a loving God entered in just the most miraculous way. People were descending throughout the state of California. I drank in 32 states, but it seems that within a less than 2-week period of time, everybody on that amends list would appear to me in one form or another, and through no effort on my part. And I damn well better be ready. You know, I one of those illustrations is I finished with my list. I'm all hot. Oh, God, I was dreadful. I run up to Peg, and I said, I'm all done with my 9-step. And she said, I got a couple names you like. I said, give them to me. You know, God, disgusting. And she gave me name one, and I forgot this dude. This guy's name was David. I loaded the gun. I was going to kill him. I went to get him. He wasn't there. Next time I saw him, I never saw him. I talked to him on the telephone. And I said, you look, you little bastard. You look over your shoulder for the rest of your life. Because if you don't see me first, you're gone. And I'm going to take you out any way I can. And you better see me first. And I just want to warn you. Now I've forgotten him. And that boy's revealed to you in this program. Wasn't self-deception is the name of the game, for Christ's sake. You have to... What I understand, the definition of grasping and developing a manner of living, to be demanding rigorous honesty, because that's one of the terms and conditions, the reason, one of the reasons, the possibly the major reason I get to stay here is because it says at the very beginning in our preamble, or in chapter 5, it says those who do not recover, people cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. They're not at fault. They seem to be born that way. They're naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living demanding rigorous honesty. And I define Carney's definition, write it down, it's important, is freedom, honesty is freedom from self-deception. Because I think that's what it's all about. You see, I wasn't an alcoholic. I drank alcoholically for 30 years. I drank the same night, the first night I drank alcohol, including the last night I drank alcohol, I drank exactly the same way, as like a pig, as much as I could get down. I stayed sober as long as I could, and then I stayed drunk as long as I could. That's it. And I never once thought of the disease of alcoholism. It never entered my mind. Self-deception is the name of the game. Anyway, this guy, I was at a bowling alley where Peg came up with this guy's name. I hadn't gone bowling alleys, I used to. And I came home. And I said, God, I wonder how I can get him. I haven't seen him in 7 or 8 years. It's a good thing. Yeah, I still had the gun. Gave it away later. That's when I gave my gun away. My gun's away. But as I walked in the telephone, walked into my house, the telephone was ringing. This is just really the way my night step went. The telephone was ringing. And I picked it up. It was my daughter who lived in Nebraska at that time. And we chatted with me, and she said this, that, because she had heard about my sobriety, and she knew it was really good. And I said, by the way, Linda, do you happen to know whatever happened to David? She said, yes, Daddy, I do. Why do you ask? And I said, well, and I told her the story, and she said, yes, Daddy, I know. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to make amends to him if I can. She said, just a minute, he's standing right beside me. But I finished my ninth step, and then I went to my sponsor and I said, I've got some people on my list that I cannot make amends to. This is part of also a very fundamental and key part of my life. I've never shared this with, I think, but two people. But I will share it this evening because it seems to be wanted to share. Is that I had my first wife who had died. I had my mother and father, brothers and sisters. Just as a place of point of interest, that I have one brother who is still alive. I come from a large family, and the Carneys run into large families. And my brother he has never drank alcohol in his entire life. And I don't know why. Probably because he's not an alcoholic. He did a survey once on the Carneys, and he retired as a young man. And he said to me when we went down to the funeral of my brother here a few years ago, my last brother that was alive, he said, do you happen to know why I retired early? I said, no. Never ask you. He said, well, I did a research on the family trees and I find out that every Carney male has died by the age of 55. No one has lived longer than that. And I figured that he figured that he was going to die at 55, so he retired to enjoy life. Bastard never told me. I lived in ignorance. But it's interestingly enough, you know, that my brother is the only Carney that ever drank, and I'm the only alcoholic that ever got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and all the rest of them died drunk. That's through six generations of Carneys. That's a powerful thing. But anyway, I had amends to make to the departed, and I couldn't do it, and I went to my sponsor, and I asked him about it, and he said, you would if you could, but you can't, and that's the way it is. It's a 10-step, and it wasn't good enough for me. I had to do more. So I talk about my wife, and I love that lady. I know some things about life today, a lot more certainly than I did before I got here, because, you see, I have been able to mind my dirty, dark past, and I've gotten some value, and there's a lot of people that seem to think that I have a lot of knowledge, and I can assure you I've had a hell of a lot of experiences, and when I got here in sobriety, I started to get the lessons from those experiences. But this is what profound change. I've had many changes that have profoundly affected my life, and all of them for the better in Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is one that might explain something to some people if they would like. So I'm a very gentle person today, because I like it, and because it's a natural sequence of doing the things that I had to do. And I went to my maker in prayer to find out how I could make amends to my wife. I found out that there's at least, that I know for a cold fact that you can have at least two great loves in life. And I've enjoyed two of them. But the first one I didn't know, because I was an ass, I was a drunk, I was a fool, and I was macho. And I had a lady that adored me, and I adored her, and I was playing the game many, unfortunately, people do, both male and female. You got to be cool at any cost. You can't tell them how much you love them. You can't demonstrate it because you got to protect your territory. And if I got one regret, and one major regret in life, it's the fact that that lady had to die, and I never, ever truly told her how much I cared about her. And I said, how am I going to make that up? And so I have a living amends. I have several living amends, but I'll share one of them. Is that I get accused of doing an awful lot of fraternization with young ladies. Okay? Now, I can do that because I'm an exceptionally happy, married man. And I have no motives whatsoever other than being a friend. And my method of making a living amends to my wife, my first wife, Eleanor, to be an extra special gentle with ladies, to demonstrate my love and care, and do for them what I could not do for my wife. Extra gentle, extra compassionate, demonstrative in love. And I started doing that, and as a result of that, my life changed. And I think I'd like to say that I do it because I'm a good person. And that may very well be true, because I probably am. But that's not the motive behind it. You see, it's the 12 steps of recovery, but it's all about it. See, when I tell you this is the only good life I've ever known, it's the only easy life that has ever been mine, it just absolutely blows my heart. You see, I looked out in the world with the eyes of a man who was angry, hateful, dishonest and untrustworthy, and that's the way the world was reflected back on me. And I did nothing but take from life because I did not know how to give. I drank my way in here. I will not drink my way out, I can assure you of that. I came in here and there's a beautiful man that I love beyond all men who taught me that heaven was a new pair of glasses. And I have new glasses on today, and I look out on the world, and I see different things than I used to see. And I don't necessarily see what you see. And it's not important that you see what I see. It's important for me to see what I see. And I see the gentleness, and I see the beauty. I see the excitement. I see the thrill of the 11 newcomers who introduce themselves. And I see the awesomeness that is available to you. I see the opportunity to become somebody. I was 2 years sober. And I woke up in an AA meeting on a Sunday evening and suddenly realized, my God, I'm everything I've ever wanted to be, and I have been for over 2 years. What an awesome awareness that was. It was good, but also I became somebody again. I became important, and I have had to constantly have to deal with the fact that I am somebody, I am important, and I have to learn how to get rid of that crap and not accept it. Because if its acceptance belongs to anything, it belongs to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am in with an unbelievably fine relationship with my wife, with my children, and with you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Not my partners, but everybody else. It is amazing to me that if you, even my business, for Christ's sake, is a 12-step call. Somebody asked for help, and because of the principles of recovery, I had to help them. And I wind up owning a total business. Not because I was looking for a business, but as a prayer. I have known freedom, and I know freedom that few men will ever know. I could go on with the prayers. One of the great prayers that I was given, just a spontaneous prayer when I had told my father when I was newfound sober, I said to him, Father, why is it that you give someone like me, unfit, unworthy, untrustworthy, and unfit, you give so much to me? Why is it that you give so much to me? I don't understand it because I don't deserve this. And the Father of my understanding and the voice that came in said, simply give it back. And I've been trying to do that ever since. I've been saying for quite a while, I was saying for quite a few years that the world's a better place because I'm sober. I've changed that a few years ago, and I can tell you that the world is a better place because I'm in it. Why? Because I can practice principles in all of my affairs. The least I do is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of the greatest things that have ever happened in my life, you will never know, because it's between me and God and an anonymous human being. Some that gives me some of the greatest joy are those things that I can do. And for those of you who've been there, and you're those of you on this journey who have not had some of the excitement and the thrills that are mine, they are available. I believe they're available to all of us. The 12 steps of recovery are bounty. Be greedy. Go for it. There's enough for all of us when someone like myself can come here unfit, thinking that the good ones died and rotten people like me live, and I can turn into a thing of beauty. Everything. I believe sincerely that when you strip aside the machoism that is inherent in seemingly all men and women, everybody wants to be pretty inside. And we all are, and that prettiness can unfold. You can take someone like me, someone like yourself, who is nothing to contribute to sobriety, and in an amazingly short period of time, you can become somebody. You can become worthwhile. You can become an intelligent agent, a spearhead of God's ever-advancing creation. Thank you.